Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070. The ongoing debate regarding the Kinder Morgan transbound expansion, so many facets. One of the concerns that I believe is legitimate, that I do think about and I do worry about, is what will happen in terms of increased ship traffic with the 76 southern resident killer whales that remain. There's technically 77 of them left on Earth. One of them's in a tank in Miami. It's very sad. I don't like the idea of whales in captivity, given the evidence that it is extremely harmful to them psychologically, physiologically, et cetera, et cetera. I want to talk about the 76 that are still in our waters around Vancouver Island. The three pods. I'm not going to get into the details of all of them at this point. The last one was born in November of the year 2015. The youngest southern resident killer whale in existence will turn 3 years old this November. Designation L123. His name's Lazuli. His mother's name's Lapis. Lapis Lazuli, like the gemstone? Yeah, you get that. What is happening to these animals, as far as biologists can tell, is that a combination of environmental stresses, such as noise, such as biological chemical contaminants, as well as a lack of food, is making it so these female orca whales, for whatever reason, are unable to carry a pregnancy to term and birth a live calf. We have also seen some of the younger calves that have been born wash up with signs of what they call peanut head. That's a sign of emaciation on the orca. It's the equivalent of a human being looking so thin that they are almost skeletal. You look at that person, you know that person was starving. That is similar to what happened with a whale that washed up, I believe it was about a year ago, a juvenile whale off Tofino. Talking about what needs to happen to save these animals is a very complicated question, because if one ship per day really is the difference between survival and not surviving, then if we have one extra container ship coming in because the Port of Vancouver traffic continues to increase, which we expect it will anyway for container ships, or the Port of Seattle as its container ships increase, or the U.S. Navy starts running more ships through, that would be just as harmful for these animals. You can see how the conversation becomes very complicated very quickly. I want to bring Misty McDuffie on to do an update, because there have been calls for the federal government to do something, anything, to save little Lazuli and his kind. Misty, a pleasure as always. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thanks, Adam.
Last time we spoke, there was an urgent call made on the government of Canada to do something, anything. Update us on that.
Yeah, so at the end of January, five conservation organizations represented by EcoJustice, which are our legal counsel, sent a petition in effect to the federal government saying that we are requesting that you use the powers under the Species at Risk Act to implement an order that will put in place the kind of regulatory structure that we need to protect these whales. And we requested responses by certain times, and as of late, we sent a strongly worded letter to the government a few weeks ago now, saying we are not seeing the kind of action and response that we are looking for. Can you please let us know by May the 1st, oddly enough, whether you plan to take the measures identified in this 60-page document of the actual things that could be done to reduce threats to these whales. And as of today, we have not seen the federal government respond to recognize that this is an urgent situation. These whales have been on the Species at Risk Act, listed under the Species at Risk Act since 2002, and to date, nothing to reduce the threats has been done. So that's where we sit. It's May the 1st. This is the day that we expected them to have a final response to us, and so far we have not seen that response.
Now, I know not everybody was counting down the days. I was, which of course is why we're talking about this today. Did you expect that we would see something by now?
Yes, we said that if an emergency order isn't how you want to do this, that's fine, but give us the regulatory framework that you're going to use. Like on the East Coast, they've implemented notices to shipping to slow ships down. They've taken some action on the East Coast that we simply have not seen here. And they have essentially not given us anything. They're not implementing the, I remember in the fall when LeBlanc announced, oh, we're going to put a 200 meter distance on, on boat distances. They're not doing anything about that this year now. And so now we've got the commercial whale watching operators saying, we're going to voluntarily not approach these whales within 200 meters. But then what about all the opportunistic whale watching boats out there? There's nothing stopping them. And so without any, without a framework, without some kind of regulation to say, you know, you can't approach these whales, then nothing happens and there's no enforcement. So we're no better off in this, you know, starting in May when whales start to be more frequent in the Salish Sea than we were in any other year.
How big of a role do you think does American policy play in this? Of course, the whales spend time on both sides of the international boundary that separates Canada from America, that, of course, kind of winds around Victoria, dipping below the 49th parallel. Do the Americans have better laws than we do, worse laws? What's the story?
Well, we have a stronger recognition of what critical habitat is under the Species at Risk Act for southern resident killer whales. So our definition of critical habitat acknowledges that it has these, it's not just, you know, hatches on a map. It has biological components, acoustic components, chemical components. So in that regard, we have a stronger definition of critical habitat, but the U.S. has done more in terms of, specifically anyways, in terms of distance and the distance you can approach whales. They are ahead of us on that. And all this legislation would have done was to harmonize that U.S. Canada regulation. But in terms of fishing and the other issues that we're so concerned about, the abundance of Chinook, they're not really any further ahead, largely because Chinook are managed, we're both managing them under the same treaty.
Yeah, and I know that the Americans, now is it Chinook, I'm trying to remember, you might know, there is a proposal right now to try to breed millions of little Chinook and sort of let them into the water to try to repopulate the area, isn't there?
Yeah, so this idea of whether we can, you know, crank up hatcheries as a solution to this problem, there's some problems with it, and one is that the growing body of evidence on hatcheries indicates that they actually have an adverse effect on wild salmon.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so whether that it's really like every time humans think that we can do something better than nature, we often, takes a while, but we often, you know, find out that actually nature did it best. And so just that process of taking the eggs, like selecting the female and selecting the male and taking their eggs and their milk and then fertilizing those eggs and rearing them in an ideal environment, like the perfect environment to hatch those eggs, that it domesticates those eggs. And you start to see changes both genetically over time, but also epigenetically, which means that changes that are induced right away based on the environment that they're in, and that ultimately those hatchery fish are an inferior fish in terms of surviving in the wild than a wild fish. So their survival is much lower, and survival is a huge problem with our fisheries right now. It's this low survival that that is responsible for you know, a lot of the recent low abundance that we've seen. So hatchery fish don't survive well, but they're also reared sometimes to be bigger than when they first go into the ocean than their wild counterparts. And so initially they've got an advantage over the wild fish because they're bigger, they can there's a lot of them, they can eat up a lot of food.
Yeah.
And so they outcompete the resources that the wild fish would have.
Are the salmon the problem? You and I have talked about this in the past. Chinook used to be, what, twice the size on average that they are now? Chinook are the primary food source.
Another problem is that over the last century, and then more recently, just in the last decade or two, size has declined again. So that the size of these fish that killer whales would have evolved with was, you know, maybe, like, if you were to compare a trophy fish now with a trophy fish 100 years ago, you know, the biggest fish were coming in at the turn of the last century around, you know, 100 pounds. There's what those June hogs that would migrate up to the Columbia River were over 100 pounds. And now, you know, a 50-pound Chinook is a pretty big fish. Yeah. And the whales developed not just the biological dependence on those fish in terms of the high fat content and the foraging efficiency that they, you know, that was provided in terms of the effort and the return with a big fish, but they also shared those fish with their family, with their other members of their pod, their family unit. So we're not just seeing the decline in the numbers of salmon, we're seeing it in the size of the salmon and then also in the quality of the salmon. So at every angle, the Chinook are really key.
Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Misty McDuffie, Raincoast Conservation Foundation biologist. Today was the day. Today was the deadline. Government of Canada needs to do something, needs to announce something. So far, nothing substantive, nothing material to the actual discussion, to the actual issue has been announced. What happens next? Those questions and more after the break. Stay with us.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
There was a deadline, May 1st. Something needs to be announced by May 1st. All right, it's May the 1st. We haven't really seen what we were looking for in terms of the announcement. What happens next? Misty McDuffie, biologist with Raincoast Conservation Foundation. What does happen next, Misty McDuffie? You know, we've been through the countdown. We went through the deadline. Today is the deadline. Nothing's going to happen. What do you do now?
Well, we've been pretty clear with government in terms of the measures we need to see to not take legal action.
So what does that mean?
Well, you know, because these letters have been written by our lawyers and because we have identified the need that our willingness to take legal action in the absence of any other, in the absence of these measures. So that's the conversation we'll be having tomorrow.
Okay. Do you have a timeline on when any litigation might take place?
If we're going to act, it would probably be pretty quickly.
Let's talk about the timelines that these animals have left, Mr. McDuffie. I know that they have been brought up once again in relation to the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Expansion Project. The prospect of increased tanker traffic, increased noise, certainly is not going to help the situation with these animals. You and I have talked about, though, how increased shipping traffic in general can be very harmful to them. Increases in container traffic in and out of the Port of Vancouver, that's gone up by, I think, it's something like 14% in the last half decade. And container traffic going in and out of Seattle, also increasing. What realistically could be done at this point to try to save these animals? You mentioned reduced speeds, like on the East Coast. What would that look like?
Yeah, so the problem, no, they're reducing speeds on the East Coast largely because of ship strikes.
And okay.
So the problem with reducing speeds on our coast is that we don't know whether we're just exposing whales to noise for longer periods.
Oh, good point.
Or whether is it better to have the ship go past loud and fast, or is it better to have the ship go past slower, exposing them longer, but quieter?
Interesting.
So our position has been that until we get a handle on this and until we start to do the kind of retrofits that truly can reduce noise, because everybody agrees that noise cannot get any louder if these animals are to recover, and we have to reduce it, that we're saying that we have no increases in shipping until we get a handle on this. And until these ships are operating at a much, much quieter level. And we're a ways away from that. So what we did with Trans Mountain, because this is the issue with Kinder Morgan, is that we looked at how much time whales now spend in the presence of ships or boats. Actually, it's all vessel traffic.
Okay.
Vessel traffic. So they are in the presence of vessel traffic about 85% of the time when they are in the sailor sea. And that already has an effect that translates to reduction in foraging.
Yes.
And even with Kinder Morgan's project, they would go to above 90 and potentially above 95% of being in the presence of ships. And the thing with Kinder Morgan is that everybody agreed, both Kinder Morgan, the National Energy Board, everyone agreed that the increase in shipping traffic alone would have this significant adverse effect on the whales. And those are a combination of words that you never want to see in an environmental assessment. Significant, adverse, and more importantly, not mitigatable. And so the thing that most people don't know is that because everybody agreed and acknowledged this, that this impact on southern residents, the way the National Energy Board got around this and the fact that approving the project would be a violation of the Species at Risk Act for an endangered population, they ended the project in Burnaby. And so after going through the entire hearing process with the assumption that they're addressing the marine impacts and the effects on southern residents, in the 11th hour, they said, well, this project ends at Tidewater. This project no longer considers marine effects. And nobody knows that, and that's the basis of our lawsuit. So that you can't just, because the Species at Risk Act is an inconvenience to your project, it doesn't mean that you can try, you can avoid it. You can, and that's essentially what they did. So, yeah, so our lawsuit is based on the fact that there is a Species at Risk Act, says that we can't have these adverse effects that are not mitigatable, and that if you can't mitigate the effects of a project, then it can't go ahead. And so that's how they approved, that's how the National Energy Board approved the project and made the recommendation to the federal government, was that they were no longer assessing marine effects.
Taking a look at this, the idea of putting a cap on ship traffic, is that something that we could get the Americans on board for? Because the last thing we want to do is cap our own ship traffic, and the Americans go, great, there's more room for us, and they bring in, you know, three or four or five extra ships per day.
Yeah, and it really gets into the Wanda Fuca, because that's where the traffic is all coming into the Wanda Fuca, and then diverting south to go to Seattle or coming up Harrow Strait into Canada. There have been challenges to some of the expansions in the U.S. We do recognize the need to work more collaboratively on southern residents, and hopefully this initiative that's happening in Washington State under the governor may increase the opportunities to collaborate cross-border for southern resident killer whales.
How big of a concern is U.S. military presence? I'm sure you know that there are two nuclear Nimitz-class supercarriers based in the Salish Sea, as are there three guided missile subs, eight ballistic missile subs, and 200 killer attack class, all nuclear. Do those impact the whales, and what role should we assume they play?
Yeah, it's sonar is one of the ways, but there's also... And it gets a bit speculative, but the death of a whale about 6 years ago, L-112, was a juvenile.
Yes.
If I recall correctly, I think that the hearing damage and hemorrhaging to that whale was...
Yes, you're right. I do recall this.
...of an underwater explosion.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
Killed that whale.
Interesting.
So these are huge concerns when you're having, that's a lethal effect, and not just the sublethal effects of the impacts of sonar, which ultimately can lead to lethal effects through other ways. If these whales can't hear properly, if they've got hearing damage, that's how they earn their living is hearing and sound. So it may not be the direct thing that kills them, but indirectly it's definitely going to affect their foraging and their communication and their breeding. And
Let's talk a little bit about the continuation of the species. I've got a minute and a half left. As we mentioned, the last whale born was L-123 in November of 2015, Little Lazuli. How big of a gap can there be in births before that itself becomes a threat to the remaining species?
Yeah, and this is the question. It's a really important question, and the kind of question we tried to answer with the population viability analysis.
Yeah.
So, but the most important message from that modeling study was that if we reduce these threats, if we can increase their access to fish, just to Chinook salmon, and the availability, and reduce the immediate disturbance, like even within 400 meters, and you know, and that's why we've called for these foraging zones, these protected foraging zones, that we could eliminate the risk of extinction.
Hmm.
So, but as you say, like with not having these births, this opportunity is slipping away, and that's why we want this emergency order. That's why we have to do it now. If the population drops, this opportunity slips away, and that's why we have to take these measures now,
It is one of the biggest ecological concerns related to this project and other economic activity in the southern part of British Columbia. In my view, the plight of our 76 southern resident killer whales. Missy McDuffie, pleasure as always. Any final thoughts?
Well, you'll be hearing, I guess, within the next few days of our decision.
Okay, so I just want to be clear here. So we're not saying you're suing the government yet. We're saying you could be in the next couple of days.
Yes.
Okay, Misty, thank you. We'll be in touch soon.
Okay, thank you.
Bye now.